Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 319 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And in this podcast, I'm going to be continuing the MBME Gastroenterology Review. This is going to be series 6. And again, this is for all the USMLE exams. And again, as a reminder, if you're taking Step 2 CK Step 3 this month, I do have two comprehensive review classes taking place. One is going to be on the, I hold them in conjunction on an MBME test taking strategies course. So the first series will be like on the 17th of this month. We'll be having the MBME test taking strategies course. And then on the 18th and the 19th of this month, we'll be having the comprehensive Step 2 CK Step 3 courses. There'll be 10 hours each day. I just designed that specific session just to help people's schedules, people that cannot take so many days off from rotations. And then at the end of the month, I have the MBME test taking strategies course on the 28th of June from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And then the 20-hour comprehensive review course is going to be taking place on from the 29th of June to the 2nd of July. And there's going to be like 5 hours each day. So it's going to be from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, each of those days. Again, many people have taken these courses and they've done really well on the exams. In fact, I've had people, they took the course like right before their test and it really bumped them up from like their last practice exam by 10 points, 20 points, things like that. So again, if that's something you're interested in, just shoot me an email through the website and I'll be happy to give you some more information. Okay, so let's jump right into it. So what is the disease that, and I also have a step one course as well. For those of you that are taking step one, it's going to be a 48-hour, very comprehensive review course. It's going to be taking place next month from the 19th to the 24th of July. It's a 48-hour course. We'll cover about 4,000 different scenarios as to the information that's tested on step one. And then for the step two CK course, we cover about 1,500 scenarios as to what the MBME routinely goes after on step two CK and step three, you know, peds, surgery, IM, neuro, psych, OB-GYN, biostats, ethics, and then the November 2020 changes from last year. Okay, so I'm just going to jump right into it. So what if they give you a question and they give you all these pieces of information, right? So you have like a 45-year-old female. They tell you that she has lots of itching, she has yellow eyes, she has yellow skin. If you see that, what are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this is actually primary biliary cirrhosis. Remember, the name of that has changed recently. It's now called primary biliary cholangitis, right? So remember, in PBC, essentially the thing that happens is you have CD8 positive T cells, right? They actually are attracted to an antigen that you find on the surface of the mitochondrial membrane. And then they attack those cells, right? And you ultimately end up getting a lot of problems, right? So it's actually very high yield, even if, because I know many people will screw this up, right? It's actually CD8 positive T cells that are mediating the damage, and it's the intralobular bile ducts that are being destroyed. And because the reason I think I'm saying people may screw this up is, yes, they have those positive anti-mitochondrial antibodies, right? And in fact, some of these people actually have positive ANA, right? Those are things you'll find in people that have lupus. But believe it or not, it's CD8 positive T cells that actually mediate the damage, right? Of course, you know, your friends at the MBME will know that stuff, right? And they'll try to see if they can mess people up with that. So please don't be one of those people, right? So it's CD8 positive T cells that actually, again, damage the mitochondrial membrane, right? But again, the way you diagnose this disorder typically is first, you'll find the positive anti-mitochondrial antibodies in the serum. And then usually you're going to do some kind of liver biopsy and you'll see the damage to those cells. Now, remember that this is something you should really consider in a woman that's like in her 40s and her 50s. And she's like intensely pruritic. She's jaundiced, right? And she'll have like direct hyperbilirubinemia. So her direct bilirubin will be elevated, right? So that's what ultimately puts these patients in trouble. So how do we treat these people on exams? Well, the way we're going to treat them on exams is we're going to treat them with orsodiol, right? Remember, orsodiol is orsodeoxycholic acid, right? It does improve survival in people that have PBC. But if you ultimately want to cure the disorder, you need to go ahead and perform some kind of a liver transplant. That's the thing that would ultimately a saver, these patients. And this podcast, by the way, I'll try to make it somewhat short because I want to go into some deep pathophysiology on like three disorders that I'm going to talk about shortly. So what if they give you like the analogous question, right, of a guy that has like a history of chronic bloody diarrhea, and then they tell you that he has been having right upper quadrant pain for the last few weeks, and his direct bilirubin is elevated, and then you notice that his his alkaline phosphatase is also elevated. Well, what should you be thinking about in those circumstances? Well, I hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this person likely has PSC, right? Primary sclerosing cholangitis. Remember, primary sclerosing cholangitis is associated with PNCA, right? Associated with PNCA. Although that's not entirely true, but that's accurate enough for the USMLE exams. But it's associated with PNCA. And when people have a PSC, usually you find it in people that have a history of ulcerative colitis. So they will have like this history of like chronic diarrhea. Usually it's going to be bloody diarrhea. And remember, unlike PBC, where it's just the intralobular bile ducts that are affected, right? The intrahepatic bile ducts that are affected. In people that have PSC, it's the intra and the extrahepatic bile ducts that are typically affected. And unlike PBC that occurs in women, PSC tends to occur in men. PSC tends to occur in men. And typically, given orsodial doesn't do squat for patients that have PSC. Given orsodial only helps people that have PBC. The only way you can cure PSC is by getting the person a liver transplant. It's by getting the person a liver transplant. I mean, if they're having a lot of itching, and let's say a liver is not immediately available, one thing you can do is you can do an ERCP and then try to install like some stents in some of their biliary ducts to help with drainage. But again, that's just a temporizing measure. It doesn't really improve survival, doesn't really do squat for those patients. So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Now, what if they give you a question about a 17-year-old male? They tell you that he has diabetes, right? And then they tell you that he also has like skin, like a shiny complexion to his skin, right? Like he has skin hyperpigmentation. If you see this, I really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this person has hereditary hemochromatosis, right? I know some of you may be like, Divine, why are we talking about hemochromatosis? The thing is, again, that's why this GI series, I'm going to make sure that I really break things down, right? Your friends at the MBME, they love this stuff where they just, again, make tons of integrations, right? And again, people don't necessarily study that way for exams, right? But hemochromatosis is a well-defined GI disorder that your friends at the MBME love to go after, right? So why do these people have diabetes? Well, the reason they have diabetes is because their pancreas has been messed up significantly, right? So remember, people that have hemochromatosis, and again, I'll talk about the pathophys. Whenever people have hemochromatosis, typically those people's pancreases have been destroyed by the Fenton reaction, right? And when it's destroyed by the Fenton reaction, you then notice that, oh, wow, the person's pancreas is dead. When your pancreas is dead, unfortunately, you're not going to be able to make insulin, right? So you're going to get like an insulin-dependent diabetes from that. And then in addition to that, you're not going to be making your pancreatic enzymes, right? So these people can have fat malabsorption. So they can give you like a vitamin A, D, E, or K deficiency on the question on the exam with that. And then remember, these people can also destroy their testes, right? So again, many times they tend to be infertile, right? And remember that this is also associated with people getting restrictive cardiomyopathy. Right? Yes, don't get me wrong, hemochromatosis can also cause dilated cardiomyopathy. But many times on MBME exams, for whatever bizarre reason, they're a little more selective about going with that restrictive cardiomyopathy. Again, if you remember from I think it's episode 129, it's a very good pulmonology podcast. I talk about like the Rose's rule for things that cause restrictive cardiomyopathy or restrictive lung disease. Anything that ends in osis, for whatever bizarre reason, tends to cause restrictive disease of the involved organ. That's like a relatively reliable rule for the USMLE exams. And again, I'll talk about the pathophys behind hemochromatosis. But one other thing I want to say is that remember, if they give you a question about a person that has hemochromatosis, don't forget that it can affect the joints, right? So CPPD, right, the calcium pyrophosphate dihydrate deposition disease, has a very strong association with hereditary hemochromatosis on MBME exams. Now, what if they give you a question about a 17-year-old male and they tell you that he has all these Parkinsonian symptoms, right? So he has very small handwriting, right? Has a echinacea and all those things. He has hepatosplenomegaly, right? And then they tell you that you see some corneal abnormalities on fundoscopic exam. If you see this, right, I want you to think about Wilson's disease, right? I want you to think about Wilson's disease. Basically, it will present in a young person, and the person will have neuropsych problems and liver problems. That's the classic thing you want to keep in mind, right? They'll have neuropsych problems, they'll have liver problems, right? If you see that, I really want you to think about Wilson's disease. Remember, another name that your friends at the NBME could use for Wilson's disease is, they can call it hepatolenticular degeneration. I'll say that again, hepatolenticular degeneration. Remember, one thing our friends at the NBME love doing these days, they love taking things you know and then putting like different words that people are not used to, right? Like neural tube defects. Instead of calling it a neural tube defect on the exam, they'll call it a spinal dysraphism, right? So it's just something you want to keep at the back of your mind for these tests, right? And remember that people that have Wilson's disease, you definitely don't want to give them the copper IUD, right? The copper intrauterine device, if it's a woman that has Wilson's disease, because they already have copper excess, right? So why would you want to give them extra copper? That doesn't make any sense, right? So just something to keep in mind. That's a nice way they can integrate that with OB-GYN on NBME exams. And then what if they give you a question about a 17-year-old male? They tell you that he presents with hepatosplenomegaly, and they tell you that, you know, multiple family members have died from like respiratory problems in their 50s. And then they tell you that, they perform a liver biopsy and they find PAS positive intrahepatic inclusions, right? So you see these PS positive inclusions within hepatocytes. If you see that, I want you to think about alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, right? Alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. Remember, alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency is associated with pan-SNR emphysema, right? So I think the thing I'm going to devote the rest of this podcast to, so again, I'll try to keep this podcast short, is describing the pathophysiology behind these three just disorders, because many people tend to mix them up or just not really understand them, right? So let's talk about the pathophys behind hemochromatosis, behind Wilson's disease, and behind alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. So hemochromatosis, right? So what's the pathophysiology there, right? So the thing is, in hemochromatosis, yes, let me establish a few things. Remember, hereditary hemochromatosis is an autosomal recessive disease, right? And it tends to show up early in men, much earlier in life in men compared with women, right? Because if you're a woman, think about it, you're essentially bloodletting every month. Because remember, one of the ways we treat hemochromatosis is with phlebotomy, right? So, but by being a woman, because you're having your period, you're literally bloodletting every month. So people, women that have hereditary hemochromatosis, they tend to not have problems until later, right? And again, it arises typically from like a C2H2Y or a H63D gene mutation. I'll say that again, from a C2H2Y or from a H63D gene mutation, right? Now, one unusual thing that your friends at the NBME love to do with hereditary hemochromatosis is they love to give you these iron labs that you classically see in anemias. And then they'll try to see if you can deduce what the iron labs will look like in a person that has hemochromatosis. Well, again, if you understand the fact that hemochromatosis is an iron overload disorder, then you can easily make these integrations, right? So if you think about it, people that have hereditary hemochromatosis, it's an iron overload disorder, right? So that means their iron stores will be very full. So their ferritin is going to be really high. Well, if you think about it, if your ferritin is really high, then your TIBC is going to be really low, right? Because your body is like, I have a ton of iron. I don't need extra iron around. I don't need to be sending out transferring to keep scoring more iron. So these people's TIBC is going to be low. And then if you think about it, because they have so much iron, their transferrin saturation is going to be low as well, right? Their transferrin saturation is going to be high. So their percent transferrin saturation is going to be high, because that transferrin that is even around, even if it's little, has so much iron on it, right? So that's very high yield to keep at the back of your mind on exams, right? So let's talk about the pathophysiology, right? So let's talk about, many times to understand pathophysiology on NBME exams, it's best to understand what happens in the normal case if you don't have disease. And then after that, you then ask yourself, oh, okay, what is the thing that happens when you do have disease, right? So let's think about this, right? So this, many times you may see on exams that they say that, oh, people that have hereditary hemochromatosis, right? They have a HFE gene mutation. That's another gene mutation they can throw in, right? So this HFE gene, typically what it does is, you know, obviously if it's a gene, if you transcribe it, you'll make the HF, and you, if you undergo the process of, you know, transcription and translation, you'll make the HFE protein, right? And then that HFE protein, it has one job description. Its job description is to help transferring binds to the transferrin receptor on duodenal cells. Remember, the duodenum is part of the small intestine, right? So it helps transferrin bind to the transferrin receptor on duodenal cells so that you can suck in iron that way, right? But the thing is, If transferring, so transferring can be in one of two states. You can have transferring bound to iron, or transferring that is not bound to iron. The thing is, whenever transferring, so transferring that is not bound to iron can bind to the transferring receptor on the duodenal cells. Transferring that is also bound to iron can bind to, it can also bind to the transferring receptor on the duodenal cells. So let me say this again, just so people get it. Transferring can exist in one of two states. You can have transferring straight up on its own with no iron on it. That has the ability to bind to transferring receptors on the duodenal cells. On the flip side, you also have transferring that can be bound to iron, right? That's like saturated transferring. That transferring bound to iron also has the ability to bind to the transferring receptor on duodenal cells, right? And again, the thing that makes these interactions happen is the HFE protein, right? Is the HFE protein. Now, the thing is, the thing that we're most concerned with, because many people know hemochromatosis as an iron overload disorder, right? So let's take this path of his a little bit more, right? So the thing is, whenever you have transferrin that has iron on it, right? Whenever you have transferrin that has iron on it, that essentially tells your body that there is a lot of iron available, right? If transferrin has iron on it, it tells the body that, okay, there's a lot of iron available. We don't need to be reabsorbing a lot of iron, right? Because remember, iron is reabsorbed in the duodenum. So the thing is, whenever you have transferrin bound to iron, if that HFE protein helps it bind to the transferrin receptor on duodenal cells, guess what happens? It actually causes an increase in hepcidin synthesis, right? So the thing is, once hepcidin synthesis goes up, that's going to kill the reabsorption of iron in the duodenum. I'll say that again. Once hepcidin synthesis goes up, that's going to kill iron reabsorption in the duodenum, right? So if you kill iron reabsorption in the duodenum, right, then you're not going to be reabsorbing that excess iron, right? So let's see how this relates to the pathophase of hereditary hemochromatosis. The thing is, in hereditary hemochromatosis, the HFE protein does not work, right? The HFE protein does not work. So because the HFE protein does not work, iron that is bound to transferrin is not able to bind to that transferrin receptor in the duodenal cells, right? So since that does not happen, you have a tonically decreased synthesis of hepcidin. I'll say that again. You have a tonically decreased synthesis of hepcidin. If you have that tonically decreased synthesis of hepcidin, then you're going to have unrestricted iron reabsorption, right? Unrestricted iron reabsorption, right? And that iron can deposit in the skin. That can cause that bronze skin hyperpigmentation. That iron can deposit in the heart. And remember, iron can generate free radicals. It generates these hydroxy. That's actually very high yield to know. It generates these hydroxy free radicals, right? So that can cause the fainting reaction, right? So if that iron deposits in the heart, you can have free radical damage of the heart, and that's going to cause restrictive cardiomyopathy, right? And then remember that, again, this iron, right, can bind to beta cells of the pancreas. You trigger a fainting reaction, and then you're going to go ahead and destroy the person's pancreas, and the person will get diabetes mellitus. That's where this bronze diabetes moniker comes from with hereditary hemochromatosis, right? So hopefully, again, hereditary hemochromatosis makes a lot of sense. If you really think about it, if you understand the pathophase, then all the findings seem like a joke to you, right? Because you're like, oh, wait, this actually makes a ton of sense, right? Again, that's the way to go with many of these USMLE exams. Now, let's talk about Wilson's disease, right? So what's the pathophysiology behind Wilson's disease? So remember, in Wilson's disease, it's an autosomal recessive disease, right? Wilson's disease is an autosomal recessive disease. And one thing I forgot to say about hemochromatosis, again, you treat those people with phlebotomy. But another thing you can also do on exams is to give these people iron chelators, like deferoxamine, right? You give those people deferoxamine, right? And it's an iron chelator. It binds up iron, right? So Wilson's disease, again, remember, this is actually an autosomal recessive disease, right? And for the most part, you treat it with penicillamine, right? Because that penicillamine will help you chelate that copper, right? It will help you chelate that copper. So again, let's talk about the pathophase behind Wilson's disease, right? So the thing is, the normal situation, again, let's talk about normal first. The normal thing that happens is that your liver makes ceruloplasmin, right? Ceruloplasmin is a protein that binds blood copper. It binds about 95% of the copper that you find in your blood, right? So another thing that also happens is the liver takes up the ceruloplasmin and then degrades it. This ceruloplasmin that has bound copper, right? The liver takes it up, degrades it. When the liver degrades it, it then takes that copper and then excretes it into the bile, right? So that's the normal, and then obviously you get rid of the copper that way, right? So what are the problems that arise in Wilson's disease? The problems that arise in Wilson's disease are twofold. It's a transporter defect, right? The first thing I think I want you to understand is that Wilson's disease is a transporter defect, right? Wilson's disease is a transporter defect. So what is the first thing that happens in Wilson's disease? Well, copper is not embedded in ceruloplasmin, right? So copper does not hang with ceruloplasmin. Well, if you think about it, because copper is not embedded in ceruloplasmin, the person's liver copper is going to be increased, right? And the thing is, because of this transporter defect, you are not even putting that ceruloplasmin into the blood. I'll say that again. You're not even putting the ceruloplasmin into the blood in the first place, right? So the serum ceruloplasmin tends to be decreased. In fact, that's one of the diagnostic tests that's employed in people that have Wilson's disease, right? And then another thing that is associated with this transporter defect is even that copper that you have from degraded ceruloplasmin is actually not excreted in bile. I'll say that again. That copper that is from degraded ceruloplasmin is not excreted in bile, right? So if all these things happen, you have a buildup of copper, and this copper can begin to deposit in organs. And we know that copper, again, can generate a lot of free radicals by the Fenton reaction. The Fenton reaction is not an iron-exclusive reaction. It also happens with copper, right? So if that copper, excess copper, begins to damage the liver, that's how these people get cirrhosis. And if it binds to the putamen, right, it can cause Parkinson's-like problems, right? Because remember, the putamen is actually a part of the basal ganglia. And also, copper can deposit in the subthalamic nucleus, so it can cause hemibalismus. In fact, hemibalismus is a pretty classic finding in people that have Wilson's disease, right? And it can also deposit in the cornea, right? That's how you get those Kaiser Fleischer rings that we find in people that have Wilson's disease, right? So again, hopefully Wilson's disease now makes sense, right? So now the last disorder I'll talk about before we then wrap up for today is alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, right? So again, what's the pathophase? Again, some key things I think I want to mention is, remember, alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency has autosomal dominant inheritance, right? Autosomal co-dominant inheritance for the most part, right? And many times on exams, they like you to know what the alleles are, right? So remember, the normal situation is that you have the MM allele, right? The MM allele. M as a mom, the mom allele, right? But if you're MZ, you're a heterozygote, right? You'll have like mild alpha-1 antitrypsin disease. But if you're a ZZ, right, so like Z as in zebra, if you're a homozygote, you're going to get the recessive disease. And also, one other thing I think I want to mention is that the S allele is also bad. Having that S allele is also bad as well, right? So the Z and the S alleles are not good, right? So the thing is, in alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, what is the primary pathophase? The primary pathophysiology is that when you have the mutation, the alpha-1 antitrypsin you produce cannot fold properly. I'll say that again. When you have that gene mutation, the alpha-1 antitrypsin that you produce cannot fold properly. So it's a folding problem, right? So because you have this folding problem, the alpha-1 antitrypsin is actually going to accumulate in the endoplasmic reticulum of hepatocytes, right? So that alpha-1 antitrypsin, that misfolded alpha-1 antitrypsin, is going to accumulate in the endoplasmic reticulum of hepatocytes, right? And the thing that happens is that if that alpha-1 antitrypsin accumulates, right, it triggers something called the unfolded protein response, which will begin to cause damage of hepatocytes, right? And again, if hepatocytes get damaged, right, that's going to cause cirrhosis. In fact, let me tell you this. The most common cause, this is very high yield, the most common cause of cirrhosis in kids is alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. I'll say it again. The most common cause of cirrhosis in kids is alpha-1, not newborns, kids, right? Like a kid that has, you know, like grown, is alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, right? Now, remember that many times, things that go to the endoplasmic reticulum, they ultimately end up being exocytosed into the bloodstream, right? Or at least into the intracellular environment. When a person has alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, again, because of that unfolded protein response, and because that protein doesn't fold well in the endoplasmic reticulum, right? That ER Golgi pathway doesn't work well for alpha-1 antitrypsin. So it never gets exocytosed to get to the lungs, right? So essentially, the neutrophil elastase will have a field day in the lungs, and it's going to go ahead and destroy the person's lungs. That's how these people get pan-acinar. It's very high up. Pan-acinar emphysema, right? This is how these people get pan-acinar emphysema, right? So that's the pathophase behind alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. And many times you just try to tell these people to stop smoking. If they don't smoke, right, their life expectancy is roughly similar to a person that does not have alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, that has never smoked either, right? But again, unfortunately, the liver disease can cause problems, right? So sometimes these people will need a liver transplant. So I think that's all I'm going to say, and I'm going to go ahead and pause here. As I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer courses again for step one, step two, CK, and step three. They're very comprehensive review courses. And I also work with people on their ERAS applications, although that's done entirely offline. So if you have like red flags, problems with your personal statements and things like that, recommendation letters, I work with people on all those things. I've worked with people with many red flags on the applications that are currently residents. In fact, I've been getting a lot of emails recently from people that I worked with this past cycle that, you know, are starting residency like next week or something like that. Now, one thing I wanted to say, so many of you, you know, that listen to this podcast, you know, I'm a Christian, right? So the thing is, I usually put life lessons at the end of these podcasts, right? But many people have gotten tons and tons and tons of emails from people saying that, wow, Divine, these life lessons really helped me a lot. So one thing I've decided to do is actually started another website, Divine Intervention Life Lessons, right? So if you go to divineinterventionlifelessons.com, you will see that I did, in fact, start this new website. And basically, the goal of this new website is to just have very short podcasts where I talk about, you know, for the most part, again, I use like the Bible to illustrate just key life lessons that can help many people in medicine. And also not just people in medicine, just people involved in many different careers, right? So the website actually went live pretty recently. In fact, I just uploaded the first podcast. I believe that was yesterday. Or no, it was two days ago. It was a podcast on focus, right? So again, most of these podcasts will be like 5 minutes long. You can listen to it as like a devotional on your way to work or something like that. Again, just to use like Bible-based teaching to show you how that applies to the world we currently live in today. So if that's something you're interested in, again, feel free to hit up the podcast, Divine Intervention Life Lessons. If you go to the website, divineinterventionlifelessons.com, you'll actually find it. I'm actually going to be trying maybe sometime today to get it to Apple Podcast. So you see it as like a different podcast on Apple Podcast as well that you can learn a lot from. So thank you for listening to this. I will see you in the next episode. God bless you and have a wonderful day. Thank you.